So hi, my name is Gavin O'Mara. I'm the CEO and founder of FE News. And today we're going to be exploring neurodiversity. Today's episode is around funding fears. This is a co-produced FE News and Cognisys podcast mini-series exploring neurodiversity. My co-host is Louise Kowalski, who is the head of science at Cognisys. Louise, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Gavin. How are you?
Yeah, really good. I'm really excited to go into this because it's really important. It's this sort of, there's support. So how can we make this happen? Do you know what I mean? And our expert joining us today is Carl Bentley from RSM. Carl is over 20 years in the FE sector and is particularly as a funding, data and audit specialist. Carl, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, really, really good. Carl, can you sort of help unpack this for us? Today is all around exploring neurodiversity, particularly funding fears. So what funding is there available if a learner is identified with a neurodiversity? What support are funding bodies basically offering to providers to support their learners if they've got an additional learning need?
Okay, if it is a demonstrable need that is what I would describe as above and beyond what the course that they are enrolling is, they need support. And this can be all manner of things. We're not just talking about some support with maths and English. We can be deep diving into dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, all manner of things, as well as physical, mental learning difficulties, disabilities. But even we could go as far as things like confidence or the ability to be taught. You know, we've seen numerous examples over the years of things like the learner that actually has never been taught before and doesn't appreciate what's required of them. And we've actually seen learning support. One of my best examples was for basically a minder in the classroom when people just got up and thought they could walk out because they didn't think they needed to be there. And there's literally a doorman stopping them. And it's an additional cost to kind of go, I need to turn you around and put you back down in your seat so you can continue to learn, because they couldn't comprehend what was required of them. So that's the sort of thing. In terms of the funding itself, it is where it is an apprenticeship or adult education budget, it is essentially funded via the ILR. So you will have a learning support funding from and to date. And provided that the learner is still there at the end of each month, basically it will trigger a £150 payment. Now, as someone has quite rightly pointed out to me before, it's like, well, that's not written in the rules anywhere. And it's like, yep, that's perfectly right. The rules talk about how you draw it down. If you want to understand the mechanics of it, there's a wonderful document called the Funding Rates Formula document as well. So if you actually want to understand the mechanics of how it's funded and how much you get, there's also that side of it as well. You may have that scenario where £150 is not enough. Actually, you've got a person with multiple needs. They may actually need a full-time signer with them. There could be various adaptations needed, that sort of thing. And the £150 does not go far enough. And that's where you need to consider things like what we refer to as the earnings adjustment statement, which is basically as a spreadsheet that you submit to the ESFA, and effectively it funds the difference up to £19,000. Anything over 19K, that is a direct application to the SFA and they will review. And if it's upheld, they'll provide the extra funding that way. But the EAS effectively is the difference. So it's really important that you, when you are delivering and claiming funding, that you are actually tracking and monitoring, not just the claim from the ILR, but your expense as well. Because ultimately, if it's costing you £1 million, you know, if you're delivering lots of support, it's costing you £1 million and you're claiming 750, the EAS is that's the difference. That's where you claim it's through the EAS. But if the ILR is giving you 2 million and you're only spending 1 million, then you wouldn't need the EAS. You've got to kind of do that checks and balances just to always make sure that you're not indirectly overfunding yourself. Because ultimately, one of the tricks that the auditors now have in their repertoire will be so how much did you claim on your EAS? Oh, well, it's this. Well, hang on, I'll add that plus that. Okay, I've got total number. Now, can I actually start talking to you about how much it actually cost you to deliver this? Because effectively, learning support is money in, money out. You don't profit off it. It can't contribute to your overheads. it doesn't make a contribution. It effectively is, if it costs a pound, you claim a pound. If it costs £2, you claim £2. That's the process. Now, there will be, in the £150 model, there will be occasionally the times when you effectively will make a bit of surplus on it. Because if it's only costing you, say, £90 a month to deliver the support, there you go, you get 50, you know, you get 150. But you then have to factor in that there may be, if you were monitoring your costs properly, there'll be somebody that you've supported that you didn't make a claim for. But the excess that you got, your £60 excess there, you just move that to the next person, but you're not claiming. So that's why it's really, really important that when you're thinking about the funding of it, that you're kind of doing the checks and balances all the time, that you're actually considering, if it costs this, I'm claiming that, you know, and you're keeping it relatively comparable. You know, I've walked into providers where we've gone, can we look at your EAS claim? And they've gone, here you go. And we've got look at this. And they've just kind of gone, how much did it cost you total? And they gave me this number. And I just went, there's £250,000 worth of activity here that you've got that needs to go back to the agency. But we've got this wonderful model and we've costed everything. But they hadn't costed it. They'd put a price on it. So to write a letter was £35. But it was, well, how much did it really cost to write the letter? Oh, well, we just gave it to the admin support. They're doing nothing additional. They just wrote the letter for us. So you've got no cost. So how are you creating these numbers? And seriously, we have seen some major, I wouldn't describe it as profiteering, but we have seen some concerns where the ALS claim has, it's got out of control to some extent. But again, it's I don't want to come and basically scare people and have people panicking and going, oh, I don't, you know, should I claim or not? But I think what they've got to bear in mind is it's for every pound you spend, do you know what you've spent and do you know what you've claimed? And are you doing that check and balance all the time to make sure that you've, effectively, you're not actually affording to buy everybody a Tesla. That's if everyone we turn up to like everyone's got premium Tesla, they're like, I think there's a problem here. It's that kind of just be sensible with it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Louise, can I bring you in, because I want to put this into context, really, because from the data, from what you're seeing that every day, this is great that there is funding available to support learners with additional needs, but to put it in context, how many learners would that be in the typical sort of cohort? How many are you seeing? Like, is it, you know, like, to put a sort of figure on it?
Yeah, Gavin. So, I mean, we've assessed near on 100,000 learners now. And we're seeing, and obviously the trend fluctuates, as you say, daily. But we're seeing 1 in 3 apprentice learners identifying with some sort of neurodiversity. So what I mean by that is a cognitive need which brings about a barrier to their learning or their ability to complete their apprenticeship program successfully.
So that's a significant, I mean, from a data set of 100,000, which is significant, that is significant, a huge number of people, really, isn't it? So Carl, could you explain what are the main fears by colleges, providers, universities around, you know, taking the funding to support those learners that have got additional needs that have been identified as having a neurodiversity? What is it that's causing this sort of big fear and big barrier?
Ultimately, the big fear is it's losing the money. It's having it taken off them. And the challenge comes from, it's how the process works. If you think about it, you draw money down, you spend money, you draw money down, you spend money, and you do this in a cycle. Up, and you continue to support delivering the learner, incurring cost. And then audit turns up. And you're never quite sure when it's going to happen, because, you know, ultimately, it's part of the battle is, you know, you never know when it's happening, but audit turns up, we find an issue, and actually we deem the provision to be ineligible. And that basically triggers a recovery of funds. So someone comes in, looks at it and goes, no, you can't demonstrate that you've delivered anything additional, or we can't see that you've incurred extra cost, etc. Therefore, our solution is it's ineligible and you'll have to pay it back. The challenge comes from, basically, it's where do you find the money to pay it back? You've had it, you've spent it, you've had it, you've spent it, and you've still got your staff, you've still got your premises, you're still incurring the costs, you're still delivering the support, but you've now got this debt that you've got to pay back. And ultimately, if you can't pay it back, you probably can't go back, can't go to the bank and ask for an exceptionally large overdraft and go, oh, well, could you just bail me out on this one? You're probably not going to be able to get a loan to cover it. The agency does not provide support for independent training providers. You know, if you're a college, you may be able to get exceptional support if it's a significantly large amount. But even that's becoming a challenge now. And you could actually see a college having to go, oh, well, we're going into the insolvency regime. This is the things that nobody wants, ultimately, at the end of the day. And I think that's the biggest fear, is that what happens is that people get so worried and so paranoid that, you know, that the spectre of taking the money back is because I don't know if my evidence is good enough. I don't know if I've done this right. I can't probably go and ask the agency for an independent view to go, this is what we're doing. We think we meet the rules. Could you give us a view? And let's face it, the response back is, here's the relevant paragraphs from the funding rules. Go read them again. And it's not helpful, because actually sometimes you want somebody to go, yes, that's okay. And I think this is where sometimes it becomes a challenge and people go into a fear culture. A recovery happens, it spreads like wildfire. People go on to you know, what was it, FE Connect, now ESFA Communities, Gismail. They go into their silos and start going, well, provider up the road just had a 250K recovery for learning support for the last 2 years because the auditor didn't understand it. So they just clawed the money back. And I think that's one of the big challenges with some of the, dare I say, with some of the neurodiversity stuff, because it is still actually relatively new as well. Yeah. It's been around for a number of years, but one of the things you have to appreciate with some of these auditors is we're quite long in the tooth. You talked about, I celebrate my 25th anniversary in FE this year. And I have to keep relearning every time there's a new methodology. We all have to relearn it. And neurodiversity is another barrier that auditors have to get their head around as well, which is, so what does this mean? It's all new and shiny. It's not traditional stuff. So it's not adaptation, and it's not some equipment, and it's not this. I don't know what it is. I'll disallow it. And that's some of the scenarios that we've seen. And when I first started, and I'll be honest, that's how my conversation with Cognosy started, was I didn't understand it. I talked about it at the conference and just went, if somebody can help me with this, because I need to get my head around it to understand it from a professional point of view, what is it actually doing? And I think that's something that any auditor listening to, you need to take this away, is to take 5 minutes to understand what's been presented to you before you get the red pen out and start disallowing stuff. And have that conversation with the provider. What impact has it had? I can see you've spent the money. Now I need to know what impact it's had. Oh, retention's gone up. Achievement's gone up. Your payroll's gone up. I now can connect all the dots. But it's going to take a brave provider and an open-minded auditor for that to happen. And I think at the moment, a lot of providers will just go, you know what? I'm just going to do it, deliver it. And Louise's point, perfect. Over 100,000 people with a need. And then I arrive as an auditor. I open up the PDSAT reports for learning support. How many have you got? 10. How many learners have you got? 5,000. Something's not right. Yeah. That proportion, it just doesn't look right. And when you start asking the questions about, well, why have you got so little? We're not confident. We don't feel that we can justify the claim. So we just do it and we don't bother claiming. And that's to the detriment of the sector.
And the learner.
Yeah. Well, I think the learner's still getting that support. But what's happening is that to pay for that, you've got to cut corners somewhere else. And then that's where you start getting the financial issues coming in of, well, the apprenticeship program wasn't quite as robust as it could have been because we had to borrow some money off that to pay for that rather than that the second activity being paid for in its own right. So I think providers have got to kind of seize this and go, you know what, we've got to show some confidence with this and we've got to start claiming the money because we are supporting the learners. We are doing everything right. But ultimately, it's going to start hitting on the bottom line and it becomes unsustainable. That's the big challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is the whole reason for this podcast, really, is to help offer this sort of confidence and support to people. But at the same time, the funding's there to remove a barrier for the learner. but the funding fear is causing a barrier to the provider to deliver it. I mean, Louise, you must come across this all the time with people that are, you know, new to the concept of, you know, neurodiversity. I mean, how, you know, you've got loads, 100,000, you know, data set is 100,000 assessments. Mm-hmm. That's a lot. So there's obviously been a big stage and a big process of onboarding teams. So anything you can sort of take from your experience of onboarding teams to then maybe convert this into funding? Do you know what I mean? How we get the rest of the team involved?
Yeah, exactly, Gavin. We spend a lot of time upskilling anybody who works with a learner, from a training provider or a college or a HEI. And you know, when before the onboarding starts, it's interesting. We always ask the question, how many of your learners are you claiming LSF for, or how many do you think have a need? And the answer is roughly between 2 and 5% usually. Okay. So they're learners that self-declare or learners that have a diagnosed need that they start their apprenticeship program with. And you know, it's really common to hear from tutors that they dread being given a learner with a diagnosed need to work with because they're scared of doing it wrong. They don't want to get it wrong for that learner. So when they go through our training, they've got the confidence. They understand, you know, this isn't rocket science. You know, we all think differently. We all learn differently. And it's about appreciating that with each other. You know, so we sort of go through, give people tips on tailoring their delivery, how to communicate better with different types of learner, what to include in a good teaching session. And it instills confidence in people who are providing that support. There's a lot of obstacles here. And that's just one that we can help knock down.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Carl, so this sort of gets to the nub of it. And the fear is clawback. And the fear is sort of clawback of several years. You just can't afford to pay it back. And I mean, you can understand why it is a fear. But at the same time, what is good best practice? What is it which people need to be identifying as an additional need? And how do you evidence it? How do you evidence that as a small provider, but also as a large one? How do you, as Louise has talked about, you know, training, getting teams on board, how do you onboard the team to evidence this well?
I mean, the key thing in all of this, it comes back to assessment. It's the, if you identify the need or a potential need, you assess it. And based on the results of that assessment, you make a decision on whether it needs to be supported or not. And once you've got that assessment, it's in the plan. So, okay, what do we need to do to address this need? Does it require equipment? Does it require some of the more straightforward things? Does it need a signer? Does it need a scribe? Is it additional exam time? Is it that sort of really straightforward, simple stuff that I use the word simple flippantly, but it's that kind of old school, traditional, you know, we know what we're dealing with when we look at these things. And then when we hit the neurodiversity thing, that the challenge is when we see that assessment, that it's been properly unpacked, that it's someone's looked at it and gone, right, for the benefit of all those concerned, we've taken, and no disrespect to Louise, we've taken it and I've put it into monosyllabic, simple words for the benefit of the user and the auditor to go, this person has a problem. It is this. We will do this. It will enable them to do this. If that's set out nice and clearly to all concerned, I can't argue with it. I just sit and go, yeah, I'm happy. I can see what you're doing. And I can. And the main thing is, though, it's that you make it demonstrably clear it is not replicating what the core program is doing. So, you know, one of my favorites recently was we're claiming learning support. Brilliant. What are you doing with them? We're teaching them about medical phrases and nursing phrases. They're doing a nursing qualification. Yeah, but we're getting them ready for it. Well, isn't all this going to be covered in the nursing qualification? Yeah, a little bit later on. Why don't you just change your curriculum around so you teach it now so you don't need to claim learning support? Oh, so really we shouldn't be claiming learning support. Well, what's the barrier? They don't understand the terminology. this sort of film, and actually it looked more like a reflection on poor teaching than a real learning support need. So it's like, and then they just went, oh yeah, maybe we shouldn't claim. And it's like, no, you shouldn't claim. But then as you dig down into them, you actually then started to find that learners were then declaring that they had things like dyslexia. And you're like, how are you helping this? Oh, we hadn't noticed that. And it's like, hang on a minute, the evidence was right in front of you, but you elected to, and this is when you get into this pattern of trying to go, oh, what's the path of least resistance? What requires the least amount of work? Oh, if we do this, then we can claim some extra money. So, no, if a learner tells you something, whether in confidence or otherwise, if you can do something to address that need, it has to be, if it's clearly evidenced, and you can show it to somebody, and the audience looks at it and goes, yeah, I can see it. And then off the back of that, you can then see, based on the plan, everything that you do afterwards is following the plan. And you're then also checking and monitoring and tracking it. And I can see that you're actually, it's taking extra time. It may have additional staff brought into it. I can actually see that they're retained, they're progressing, they're getting through the program. I'm like, I can't argue with it. Because it would be a maniac who would sit there and go, nope, I'm going to take the money back. It's like, I'm sorry, but you've spent it for the purpose. You identified a need, you addressed the need, you've delivered, you get paid.
So basically what you're trying to say is you need to be able to have like quantifiable data to then be able to then have undisputable evidence, really. So you go into sort of like legal mode, sort of like Ironside, is it, or whatever. You're like sort of thinking, how am I ironsiding this learner to be able to prove that they do have a need and this is how we're helping them? Is that what you're trying to sort of show?
I think it's making sure that you have clearly identified what the need is. I think one of my first conversations with the guys at Cognosist was kind of like, it's a bit like techno babble. I don't understand it. And literally one of the guys in our team, they looked at it and just went, I don't understand any of this. I don't get it. I don't want. And there was, if anything, our barriers came down.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't get our head around what it was telling me. It just looked like, I can see some graphs. And that one, they got 84. So there's a need.
Yeah. But
what is the need? You know, and I think these are the conversations that we've had. I'd be quite happy to say that the training that Louise does, can you come and do it for our guys? Because I think we as auditors need to actually understand it as well.
Would love to.
Isn't that interesting?
It's needed.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it really interesting of where you're seeing, Carl? I mean, you know, 25 years in the sector, yeah, you're experienced, you know, and you've seen many different things. Where at the same time, isn't it great you could be like just open with this and just say, you know, there's an internal learning need here and for many others. Louise, you must see this all of the time. And it's again onboarding, isn't it? Educating the educators and educating the leaders. And how, what's the way forward here? Because we don't want barriers for providers to be able to offer the support. Do you know what I mean? So how do we just take that away, you know?
Training, communication. So we've recently released a masterclass for free to the whole sector and talking exactly about this, breaking down the understanding behind all of this in really simple language, Carl. As you know, we've had many conversations around this. That's the way forward, I think. Like, you know, be keen to learn more, be keen to know more about this. And you know, it's not just beneficial to learners, it's beneficial to yourselves, because you gain more of an understanding of how you process information, how you think and learn, how you like information to be delivered to you. And also colleagues, you know, it's not just teacher to learner. This is for everybody. We all communicate with each other. We all share information with each other. And it's how to do that to the best of your abilities, need or no need. You know, at Cognitus, we talk, like, as Carl quite rightly says, neurodiversity. And we're all on that spectrum of neurodiversity. You know, I'm keen to stay away from labels, because labels bring along stigma and reluctance to speak out. So, you know, it is very much about, we all have strengths and areas that we could do with improving on, and it's understanding that about ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one thing I was going to say, Louise, you know, the 100,000 data set. So this is really interesting here. How many learners go through an assessment and then come out with a neurodiversity or undiagnosed before? What's the sort of ratio that you're seeing?
Yeah, roughly 1 in 3.
I'd say
on average. Yeah, so these learners have, I mean, some learners will have a previous diagnosis. So yeah, they fall into that pot as well. But a huge proportion of those learners, their learning needs have been hidden. You know, even they're not aware. Sometimes they know they struggle with something.
Yeah. But
nobody sort of said, well, this is why, and this is the support you can now access.
So, Carl, something that popped into my head really. So before, say that a learner had been, didn't know they had a neurodiversity, had an additional need, they didn't say anything. They went through an assessment. What would that then mean to the provider? Would they then be able to claim from that point, or can they claim from when they started with the provider? How would it sort of work in that sort of situation?
Right. The claim has to follow the delivery of the support. So if I've been on program for a year undiagnosed and no delivery has taken place, that year's written off basically.
Right.
It's the point that if you diagnose and start delivery, it's at the point you start the delivery. So if I went through, I did an assessment today, but actually I wasn't supported until April, that's basically when the claim starts. And then the claim would stop when the delivery actually finishes. So whether we get to the end of the program or I feel that I don't need any more support. So it could be a short, sharp shock intervention.
Yeah.
And it could be that I need a couple of months of support. I'll be honest, numeracy is not my greatest thing, which is hilarious considering the sector I work. I enjoy logic. I just don't do numbers very well. But it would be, okay, I've done several months, I've done various assignments, and you basically claim the £300, so you claim 2 months of activity for me, and then you go, right, I don't need to claim anymore. The challenge actually in all of that is just remembering to turn the tap off, because you have to tell the data to stop claiming. Because if you set it for 2 months, you'll get paid for that. If you start it and leave a really long end date on it, the system will just keep paying you. And that's one of the foibles that can happen where the auditors turn up and go, I can see 2 months, but you've got another 6 months of claim. Why? And then sits there and go, oh, I forgot to turn it off.
Yeah, sure.
And then audit turns around and goes, and how many more did you forget to turn off? And then the sample goes from that one to basically the population.
Right.
It's one thing to be really mindful of is it's a funding tap that you have to remember to turn off.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a really, really good and helpful point there, actually. So it's really interesting what this can mean sort of moving forward. And we said about, it makes sense to obviously best practice, identify leads early on. We're all meant to be talking, initial assessment you'd think should pick this up. But things do fall through the net. So whose role, Carl, is it then to be evidencing the details about the additional support? Because a lot of these claims would be made by, if it's a large organisation, it'd be like an internal, very separate team to the person who's touching the learner. And obviously they're not touching the learner, but like, it's just how are they involved with moving things forward to assess and to evidence? It could be a very different team. So how do we encourage people to be able to do this?
Ultimately, everybody's got some sort of responsibility in this. The first point is actually going to be the tutor, the assessor, the person conducting initial assessment. But in some cases, it's that tutor, that person that has that regular contact with them. And it could be that that's what's going to trigger the assessment. Because it could be that the learner's come in and said, I don't have any needs. I don't believe I have any needs. And through observation, monitoring, something's coming out to kind of go, I've done my cognitive training. There's something that you're not quite grabbing here, particularly around technical language or something like that, or that your learning style is not mapping up. Do this assessment. That's going to require somebody else to get involved. So it's on that tutor to go, make sure this person gets their assessment done. once the assessment's done, it's then actually, what's the plan? Who's doing it? You know, if you're a small team, you may not actually have there may be one person that specializes in learning support, or they're kind of, they've got responsibility for it. And that's where they're going to be needing to liaise with that person, as well as the data people, to go, dear data people, right, we're going to start claiming learning support for this person. You need to turn it on this date and leave it. And the plan is, we've done a plan and we reckon it's a year's worth of support this person needs. We've got the plan, we've mapped it all out. But again, it's going to be that kind of checking in with the various people concerned. So, you know, the tutor, how is the person getting on? Are they benefiting from the support? Are they actually engaging in the support? And what is the support looking like? The biggest fear that I always have of any type of support is it's all online and it's a series of assignments and they just sit there going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And no one bothers to look at it and go, does anyone measure the impact on this? I can see they've done stuff, so we've claimed funding for it. And that's when the audit comes along and goes, I can see you've done something. What was the impact?
Yeah.
And tumbleweed goes through the audit room at that point and people just start going, oh yeah. And it's just remembering that we all like to talk about reviews. We all love to talk about, you know, like measuring impact and that sort of thing. But people don't measure impact of learning support particularly well. It's one of the key things that we pick up at audit. It gets a throwaway line. Oh, they're getting support. Okay. And what have they done in the last 3 months, 8 weeks, 16 weeks, 6 months? What have they done? Have you actually asked the individual person what impact it's made to their learning experience? That writing that down to go, well, but when I started, I couldn't do this, but now I feel confident with X, Y, Z. Audit goes, oh, yeah, okay, I can tick my box now because I can see the impact it's had on that individual. That's the bit, but again, it's that making sure that the person doing the review is aware to ask those questions, or the review is actually not just, if it's an apprentice, we're not just talking to the employer, the apprentice and the tutor. We're also bringing in the learning support person as well for their comments. And if they're not participating in that learning support, that's the point in the review to go, well, apprentice A, you've not been doing it. And actually what's noticeable is that we've noticed that there's been issues around retention. You've been noticing you've been struggling. Actually, if you engage in this, you won't be struggling and you'll be progressing. And you probably won't have your employer nagging you about timekeeping and that sort of stuff, because we'd identified this as a need. It's all in the plan. It's all there to help you, not just to become whatever it is that your apprenticeship is, whether it's a plumber, a barista, a hairdresser, whatever it is that you want to be. But actually, to be able to learn, retain information, and actually have a better life ultimately, because you're going to get so much more out of it than just the trade. You'll have so much more better life skills from doing the support ultimately.
Yeah, 100%.
It's got to be everybody. It can't just be MIS in their silo, the tutor in their silo. It's a team collaborative effort at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, Louise, you see this all the time. You work with specialists that are able to offer people with quite acute neurodiversity needs to those that are just totally new to this. I mean, what best practice have you seen of people be able to evidence and track and show impact for neurodiversity and the impact of actually delivering additional needs?
Yeah, I mean, so we've tried to make the whole conversation around support easier for people, like to make it part of the review process, to make it part of the learner journey process. So we've boiled it down to like 4 easy to understand headings. So what is the issue? What is the barrier that the learner's experiencing? What action has been taken? So, you know, what has the tutor done differently maybe for that learner that they wouldn't do for other learners? What is the impact? As Carl just said, the impact is absolutely crucial. What did it make a difference? Did, you know, I don't know, providing information on paper rather than on screen make a difference to that person? What was the impact? Did they absorb more? Could they recall more information? Could they explain things better? And then the next part is weave it in. If something works, weave it into that learner's routine. You know, as Carl says, this all leads to somebody being more confident with their learning, more confident at work, being able to cope in different situations better, ultimately having a better life. So, you know, we're trying to record this information and make it routine, you know? And if something didn't work, that warrants a conversation as well. All right, so you've tried this strategy. Why didn't it work for you? What can we do differently maybe to tweak it? For example, highlighting didn't work for this learner. Okay, well, why don't we try sticky notes? Why don't we try underlining? Why don't we try annotating books in the margin? You know, it's not cut and dry. It's like, it's trial and error. You know, it's difficult to figure out what works for people. It's difficult to figure out what works for ourselves. You know, the amount of productivity apps I've tried just don't work. I go back to old school techniques, you know, paper and pen. But this is essentially what we're trying to do with our learners, figuring out what works to be able to equip them for the future and progression.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Carl, I'll take that. Tracking the successes and the ones which you thought were going to do better would also show as evidence, right? Is that there's progress with the learner as well?
Yeah, we've got to look at everything in its quantum. You know, we can't just, if an intervention hasn't worked, doesn't mean that the auditor's going to sit and go, well, that was a waste of money, wasn't it? We're not going to be looking at it like that. What we're going to be interested in is that you've tried to do something with them. It's been, and I stress the word additional, and I think just as almost a sidebar, I'm old school. This is ALS. And when it had the word additional in it, it was really easy to audit because you just start thinking, how is it additional? How is it on top of, you know, as soon as you demonstrate to me, that's program, this is what we're doing over here. Audit has to go, yeah, okay, I can see what you're doing. It makes perfect sense. But we're not going to criticise you for basically trying something that doesn't work because, you know, as Lois said, you can't get it right first time every time. You know, if you actually, probably, if you were aware of half the audit processes that we've gone through over the years, if you tracked it for the last 5 years, the amount of changes that we do in the audit process, because think we try something and we're just like, either we don't think it works, so we drop it, or we tweak, we amend. It's like everything, you have to adapt it. And until you start actually talking to the individual and learning from it, then you can't get at it. You've got to spend that time with them to work out who they are as an individual and what they need. To think that you're going to get it right every time, it's a challenge.
Yeah, no, definitely. We're in an interesting time at the moment. You know, COVID is going into this next stage of what the pandemic means. You know, we've got figures from Office for National Statistics showing really high unemployment levels, and they're only going to go up. And this is for young people, but also for adult learners. So is additional learner support funding going to be available for all levels? And also for those adult learners who might have had an undiagnosed neurodiversity in the past, think they did really bad at school, but really they probably had a neurodiversity. So for all those that need to then go, I don't know, from a restart program when it comes on stream to going on to an apprenticeship, and there's suddenly in the initial assessment, it's identified that adult learner has got a neurodiversity. Is there support in place for everyone, or is this just for level 2 and 3? Is it to level 7? You know, is there support across the board when it comes to apprenticeships, for example?
I'd say the wonderful line that the government would raise is subject to affordability. The issue that you've got here under an era of public spending being under a massive amount of pressure, again, the ESFA's budget is not a bottomless pit. So it will have to prioritise, it will have to work out what it can and can't spend its money on. But it always has made a commitment to make funding for learning support available. you know, if there is a case there that, that it's going to improve and enable an individual to be able to successfully achieve a program, then through fair means or foul, they've traditionally always, where possible, found the money in the past. But again, we are in almost in uncharted waters here.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so the bottom line is, at the moment, until the money, magic money tree sort of, the leaves all fall off type of thing.
That's it.
We're talking here about evidence and data. And data is quite interesting because what does this mean for the longevity that we need to hold that data? What if a learner in several years' time says, well, what do you, yeah, does a GDPR request stop? What data do you hold on me? What practical advice do you have for providers to be thinking about this? So, what's the length of time they need to hold data and what should be the situation when they move forward? Because obviously data security is key, but at the same time, how long do you need to keep this in play?
In terms of data that relates to your to the funding claim that you've made with the SFA, the minimum retention requirements of that is 7 years. And effectively, the only information that you should be holding is what is required as specified by the agency. And after 7 years, then effectively you should be looking to securely dispose of it. There is the big caveat on that, though, which is if it is potential ESF match, then the requirements on that are 10 years. Now, we've just finished the 1420 ESF funding project. So that ran up until the 31st of December 2020. So effectively, on the 31st of December 2030, you should be able to have a big bonfire. But at the moment, I would probably just wait until the ESFA have told you otherwise to say, yes, you can get rid of your records or not.
And that's if we're being old school and keeping it paper and pen. Louise, you did a really good point before we did the podcast around the how COVID in particular has accelerated the use of technology. So I know you've got a whole side of things that you want to talk about around, because we're zooming instead of meeting during sort of lockdowns. You're sort of, when we come face to face, it's going to be a bit weird again, you know, when everyone's sort of able to do that. I know, Carl, you're doing remote audits, you know. Louise, did you want to share some ideas around what you've seen with use of technology with evidence?
Yeah, certainly. A lot of our clients used to deliver face-to-face prior to lockdown, whereas now it's all pretty much remote, you know. So we had a lot of conversations with clients on how to support learners remotely by way of best practice, because it's a new landscape for a lot of people, isn't it? And you know, it doesn't always work well. So for certain cognitive needs, learning through a screen or talking through a screen isn't ideal. Or also endpoint assessment, you know, so to move endpoint assessment online for every learner isn't completely right. You know, the conversation needs to be had with each and every person, like, is this all right for you? Do you see any barriers that perhaps weren't there or weren't noticeable when the learner was learning face to face? So I suppose throughout this pandemic time, the conversations we've been promoting are talk to your learners. Things change, things have changed. You know, maybe needs that didn't exist prior to lockdown could exist now. Certainly things like, you know, mental health, anxiety. We're all in a difficult state at the moment. You know, we can't pretend things are normal, although we are coming out of it. But, you know, learners will have been hit hard as well. So it's just, consider each case individually and consider each environment individually as well. That would be my advice.
No, definitely. And Carl, you know, we're going to probably step it into the hybrid time, aren't we? Do you know what I mean? We're not gone full electric yet. We're in this hybrid stage. And we're like, the old is gone, isn't it? You know, we've had a year of the fastest acceleration of education technology ever. And what would you say, with that in mind, is good use of technology for evidence? So, you know, like Zoom, WhatsApp, audio, what could be used as evidence? It isn't got to be paper and pen and sort of flown via a pigeon. How can we sort of evidence, you know, digitally for people to move forward? Because, yeah, then we don't need to have a bonfire. We just chuck that in the cloud and it's there for people to be able to access whenever they want, you know?
Well, within reason, we don't want hackers and all that sorts of stuff in there at the end of the day. Basically, if whatever you're doing, if you are demonstrating delivery, there's your evidence. The biggest challenge that providers have right now is remembering to either record it and store it, or if basically we're doing a Zoom call, Teams call, who was on the call? Actually, have you still got registers? If the answer is yes, what's stopping you filling them in? You know who was there, exactly as you would have a classroom. We're now in the virtual classroom. If you're doing a one-to-one support, it's actually using the systems that are out there, even if it's just notes in your phone or WhatsApp or something, and you're leaving a contemporaneous note of what you did, what you discussed, how long you spent doing it, and then you're moving it to a secure place so that then, you know, when the spectre of audit arrives, that evidence can be pulled out and shown. You know, there has been a history, particularly if you think about on portfolios, we've always talked about, oh, have you got photographs in the old paper portfolios? And then we started seeing videos creeping into e-portfolios. Now we're seeing recordings. And ultimately, everything is moving into the, you know, far more is on the digital platform. But it's just remembering that the acceleration that we went to get it onto digital, that you still need to leave that footprint behind to just so that you can demonstrate what actually happened. And again, it's that retention of data. We talk about 7 years. If I've got a virtual system that my staff are using or my students are using, how long is that evidence available for?
Yeah.
You know, we see a lot of VLE environments where they use it and then we come to them and go, so what happens at the end of the year? Oh, well, we just wipe it down and start again.
Right, okay.
Oh, we have had a university where we had this degree level apprenticeships, 2 years of data lost because they used a VLE that just got wiped by IT because they didn't realize the importance of that information, which it was off the job logs being, it was all there and it has now gone and they're having to try and piece it all back together. That's a lot of, you know, we're talking a couple of hundred apprentices, 2 years of data just gone. So again, it's not only just think about your document retention, it's your digital document retention as well.
Yeah.
Have you got it secure? You know, in terms of, are you storing things off-site on the cloud? Is it, you know, have you actually considered things like, you know, hacking, malware, all these sorts of things, ransoms?
GDPR.
You've got to think about all of this stuff now.
Yeah, definitely. A big old need for an ISO 27001. Got it in. Which to everyone out there is data security ISO, basically. That's really, really helpful. I think you're right. I think if we're going, you know, digital, we need to be looking, you know, let's go digital, which is great, but we need to be thinking security. We need to be thinking, like you said, like the worst case scenarios of someone just be able to press a button and delete years of data, which, you know, you're going to need to be able to reference in the future. I think so. Sort of summarizing this all up, really, this is everyone's responsibility. Like how we ask apprentices in particular to fill in their portfolio and evidence against competency is the same way, really, with delivery of, it's everyone's responsibility to evidence what they're doing with learners, really, isn't it? And to show their impact. I think from what Louise is talking about here as well, is it's onboarding the whole team to have a better understanding, but also to get involved. To remove the fear is to evidence, really, isn't it, Carl, is what you're saying. And it's also then to be able to track and show this isn't just the standard, it's additional. Everything is in addition. And I think that this thing's really, really, really important. With Ofsted, talk about deep dive. So if we're thinking about audit and funding, looking at this holistically, is this sort of the similar approach that you see as well? You need to do a deep dive on data for people.
I mean, effectively, the way that the audit works is The sample is produced via the PDSAT software, and it's a monetary unit sampler, so it will pick £1 in every so many pounds, but it will follow the activity that you as a provider have. So if you have X pounds of learning support, it will weight the sample accordingly to make sure that, you know, if it's 10% of your activity, it could be that on a sample of 30, it's only chucking in 3 or 4 learners who have additional support. But what it does is it will enable the auditors to form an opinion on the wider population. The thing is, though, if we found an error in learning support, so for example, the example we talked about earlier where you forget to turn the tap off, you find a problem like that, audit's next response will be, it's a confirmed error, systematic or isolated, and that's when the deep dive starts. Because if we feel that this is not an isolated error, we will open the population up and go, okay, well, there are 50 that in this ILR that have got learning support. We're going to look at another 10. Or we'll say to you, go away and do 100% review of the population and then tell us what you found. And then we'll review what you've done, do some additional testing to check that the funding claim is robust. So again, it's never just about that sample. That sample informs almost the route that the audit will take. You know, and if we come out and we find nothing, then great, it's straight, plain sailing straight through. But it's like everything. There are lots of junctions on this motorway. The auditors can go down as many of them as they need to basically get to the view of, can I sign the funding claim off, yes or no? So don't lose sight that, oh, they've picked 30. It may not stop there. It could depend on what we find that we will have to, we could potentially expand it into other learners and other activity.
Yeah, no, that's really, really helpful. This whole podcast is around, yeah, exploring neurodiversity is a mini series, but this has all been around the fear of funding, the fear of actually taking that sort of additional support, but then it sort of coming and biting you that you've sort of gone about it wrong. If you used to give someone some advice in one line, Cole, to take away that fear, what would it be?
Be confident. I think it's be confident in your claim. If you are absolutely resolute in your view that what you are doing is having an impact, claim it, evidence it, and argue your corner. Don't basically just let what I would politely say is one of my colleagues, a jumped up little whatever, kind of going, well, the rules say this. It's like, no, listen to me. And if you're not happy with that, ask for a ruling from the SFA, because ultimately the auditor's decision is not final. There is a policy team at the agency who will make a ruling on it. So if I say no, it's not, that's not the end of the story. If you're not happy, you've got to keep pushing.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Louise, did you, you know, obviously see this all the time. Every client you're working with has got identified learners with neurodiversity needs. Mm-hmm. What would you give as a couple of words to give people confidence to claim that funding to be able to help those learners?
They're already providing the support. Like I said earlier, this isn't anything new. To deliver good training, you have to be accommodating to your learners. You have to be considerate of your learners. So when we're talking about tailored support, it could be, I don't know, taking a picture of the appointment time for your next review session on the learner's phone and then setting up as a reminder in WhatsApp. So that could be tailored support if it's embedded into that learner's routine and it has an impact. You know, I have, this is an actual true story. I had a tutor saying the learner just could not remember the appointment time. So it was either late or just didn't turn up. And this was becoming really frustrating for both the learner and the tutor until he cracked it. That's what he did. He took a picture of the appointment, sent it to the learner. And from that moment on, the learner was always punctual, never missed another appointment. Huge impact, small strategy. So I suppose my advice is, you're already doing this. Just be mindful of how that is affecting your learner, and that can count as evidence.
Yeah, no, definitely. So really, it's purely showing evidence, really, and having those data sets to show it, isn't it? So, and if you sort of go into I don't know, I'm sort of thinking 1980s courtroom sort of big shoulder pad sort of approach of how you could show the direct impact on every single learner, identifying those needs, planning, rolling out the impact of what it's been and evidencing regularly, then Carl, then that would fly through one of your audits, I take it.
It's like everything until I've seen it. I'm your perfect lawyer type person. Until I've seen it, I won't make a comment.
But Carl, Louise, thank you so much for this helping people here to understand how they can support their learners, because everything that the sector is about is giving people that opportunity to have that foundation to just fly and just sort of be the very best person that they can, isn't it? You know, have the best opportunities they can. And this funding's there for a reason. It's there to be able to support learners. And what a shocker that people are afraid to. And Carl, thank you for explaining why, you know, and it's just, how can this hopefully help people to be able to impact just one learner? Imagine thousands and what it could bring for the rest of the sector, their communities, their families, their employers. So guys, thank you so much for your time today. And if anyone listening to the podcast wants to reach out, I'm sure you'll be more than happy for them to reach you on various different channels, LinkedIn, email and the such. And I know you'd be more than happy to help anyone who's got concerns about either their learners with Louise or with audit and funding with Carl. So thank you, Carl. Thank you, Louise. And join us for our next edition of Exploring Neurodiversity. We have 4 in the series. So if this is your first one to listen in, there are 3 more which are going to make impactful change to you, your learners, and the rest of the community. Thanks so much for joining us today. Thank you for joining me and Louise for the latest edition of Exploring Neurodiversity. This is actually one of a 4-part mini-series. All of the episodes together are Myth Busting, Steps to Outstanding, Funding Fears, and Implementing Inclusivity. So me and Louise will hopefully speak to you soon.